Next week, Ragbri riders will be crossing the state from the Missouri to the Mississippi. They'll also be cycling through thousands of years of history. It's Talk of Iowa. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. As part of a human and natural history partnership, the Office of the State Archaeologist and the DNR's Iowa Geological and Water Survey have formed cycling teams, and they've put together information to help Ragbri riders get to know the landscape and understand the history of our state. Today, they'll do the same for us. From the Les Hills to the Paleozoic Plateau, and from petroglyphs to the mines of Spain, we'll explore the archaeology and geology of Iowa. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Please join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Next week, as Ragbri riders cross the state from Sioux City to Dubuque, they'll also have a unique opportunity to get to know the landscape and learn about the early history of the state of Iowa. Today in the studio with me, I have members of Team Archaeology, the cycling team put together by the Office of the State Archaeologist. John Dorshuk is the state archaeologist, and John Hall is a GIS technician and geospatial and in the geospatial program at the office. And I'll ask you what that means in a few minutes. He's also the chair of Team Archaeology. And Ray Anderson is a geologist with the DNR's Iowa Geological and Water Survey. He'll also be along the route this year educating riders about the natural history and land formations in the state. Thank you all so much for being with us today.
Good morning.
Hi, Charity.
You are also welcome to join our conversation. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And before we get started talking about some of the interesting things that Ragbri riders can get to see or general people can get to see across the state of Iowa, I want to know how this idea came about, because having a team archaeology riding on Ragbri probably surprises some people. John, where did this idea come from?
We've been at this now for 3 years, and we actually built on an idea that Ray's organization started, I think, 6 years ago, and Ray can talk about that in a second. But we wanted to try something unique for Iowa Archaeology Month, which we've been doing since 1993, and we actually solicited ideas from our staff. And one of our staff members at that time, Cindy Nagel, had done some Ragbri activities on her own, and she thought it would be a neat way to do a statewide outreach event. So we jumped on that idea and started off.
And Ray, so this was something your organization had started doing earlier. Where did the seed of that idea come from?
Well, this is our sixth year that we've been doing this, and it really started as an opportunity to educate the public, too. The Ragbri, of course, is an extremely popular facility or endeavor, and all of the riders, of course, are experiencing the Iowa landscape. They're going up and down the Les Hills and going across the flat portions of the Iowan erosion surface or the Des Moines Lobe, and we figured that this would be an excellent time to show them exactly what they were experiencing.
And John, you clearly are a cyclist. Was this just a natural way for you to bring the two parts of your interest together?
Well, it was very convenient, actually. Cindy came to me with the idea, and then I asked Ray how they got started, and it just kind of snowballed from there. We didn't, our original ride, we weren't partners or anything then, but we'd even then said down the road we should become partners because this is a very similar type of outreach, so...
And Ray, your group travels along the route and educates people, but the archaeologists are riding the ride. So, John Hall, why are you riding instead of just along the route as well?
Well, yeah, we actually took it a step further, and we wanted a presence along the whole route. And it's such a good vehicle to show the people and educate the people about archaeology because you're actually on the road, and we have Team Archaeology jerseys, so we're very visible on the road, and... it gets people to ask questions, and that's exactly what we're looking for.
How many of you are riding this year?
We got four riders and two support people, one vehicle. There's three riders from the OSA and one from the State Historic Preservation Office that are going to ride with us. So,
did you have to cajole people in the office to do this?
Not too much. It's a long ride, so it's a little difficult. So there's, you know, we want to make sure the right people are riding. But no, there's always a lot of interest, so that's nice.
That's good. And have you guys been on training rides to get ready for this?
I think some of our riders have trained harder than others, but all are ready. They're all veterans and have done it before, so they know what they're getting into. I think that it's worth pointing out that there's more people who would ride if they could free up their personal schedules time-wise. But there's also logistical issues and the funding aspect that if you get too big a team, you need another vehicle and it gets more complex. So we're not ready to invest in a RAGBRAI bus yet, like some of the teams. So.
Maybe you can get a grant for that.
Team Archaeology Bus. I like it.
Right. Something to work on. Well, let's talk about where the ride starts, which, of course, is in Sioux City, right along the Missouri River, because a lot of the riders like to dip their back wheel in the Missouri and their front wheel in the Mississippi. So I want to start with the first thing that shows up in the brochure that you're going to be handing out, which is the Cowan site, which is very close to Sioux City. Tell me about this archaeological site, John.
The Cowan site is a remarkable opportunity, actually. Unfortunately, it's so close to the beginning of the ride that we didn't plan to set up an outreach booth there because most people will literally have been in their seat 5 minutes and not want to stop. So we included it in the brochure, though, to let people know about it. It was a village site. It dates to about 1000 A.D., and it represents a place where Native Americans, the ancestors of some of today's known tribes, first really settled into village life and became dependent on corn agriculture. So the roots of Iowa corn farming are at the Cowan site. And when we excavated there in 1998 as part of a highway improvement project, we found storage pits that were intact beneath the ground surface that contained carbonized corn kernels in huge quantities. These folks were growing and storing corn just as we do today.
Wow. And this is part of a larger civilization that is referred to as the Great Oasis.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Great Oasis is a name that archaeologists came up with first to describe a culture that was encountered at archaeological sites in southwestern Minnesota. And then as the type became better known and archaeological explorations across Iowa were done in the 60s, 70s, 80s, more examples were encountered. So as it turns out, there are more Great Oasis occupations in Iowa now than Minnesota, but the type site name comes from up there. And that name doesn't really mean anything. It's a label, but it's a convenient one to compare and contrast preceding and then descendant cultures.
Do we know how long this civilization really lasted?
Yeah, not a tremendously long time, about AD 900 to perhaps AD 1050, so about 150 years, which actually is, you know, from an individual's point of view is a long time. But archaeologically, there are many other cultures that we know about that both preceded it and then followed, some of which built on some of the same traditions that the Great Oasis people started in terms of village life, pottery development, and corn agriculture.
Okay, and so really the basis for what became the way of life all across the state of Iowa.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And also, of course, this part of the state is in the Missouri River Valley. It's in the Less Hills. So, Ray, tell me what the riders will be experiencing landscape-wise.
Well, they'll really start out in the Missouri River floodplain. That's a very flat area, of course. The sediments there were deposited by the Missouri River. Probably the Missouri River's only been in that location for a couple of million years, which is really a short period of time geologically. But then they'll get a baptism of fire very rapidly when they move up into the Luss Hills. The Luss is fine windblown silt that blew out of the Missouri River floodplain when the river was carrying meltwaters from the glaciers. And, of course, this is a very steep hill. So closer to the river you get, the steeper they are. So fortunately, though, they're in an area where they don't have to cross very much of the Luss Hills. It's a very narrow belt up there.
All right. So is this going to be the hardest day of the ride, or is there a hillier place?
Well, I think when we get to the end of the route by Dubuque, it's going to be much hillier. But the Luss Hills are always challenging, so it'll be fun.
And Ray, as people are passing through this landscape, what do you want them to notice?
Well, I think the interesting thing to see is the landforms around you. If you just look around you and look at the nature of the hills, you'll see in the Les Hills area, for instance, the hills can be very steep. You'll see these little cat steps, which looks like little small terraces along the hillsides. You see those kind of things. And then as you move eastward, your hills will be less and less steep. The less thickness becomes less and less. And then eventually you get up onto the Des Moines Lobe, which is the most recent glacial advance into Iowa and is really one of the flattest places in Iowa. So you can see a lot of interesting natural features there. You see the moraines where the glaciers stopped for a while and dumped a pile of sand and gravel. They have to pedal up over those things. You'll see little kettle holes where chunks of ice fell off the glacier and melted out and left a circular depression that's still there and filled with water probably these days. So there's lots of interesting features of the landscape to be viewed.
Well, I know a lot of riders are excited about the fact that a lot of the journey is over that flatter landscape this year. So maybe not as many hills as last year. And of course, a lot of people refer to flat landscapes as being boring. So is there something that you can do to help the riders look a little more closely and maybe see the more interesting things about that landscape?
Well, I think if you point out the details of the landscape, if you think about where it came from, the bulk of that area, I think 60% of the Des Moines Lobe was originally wetlands before settling and was drained to make farmlands and stuff. So this would have been a giant swampy area, but quite interesting back in the day. The morainal features, like I say, they're pretty fascinating. Giant piles of sand and gravel dumped off the edge of the glacier. These glaciers were like conveyor belts. They carried materials down and they dumped it off the melting edge. And where they are stagnant for a while, you see these big piles. And those moraines mark the edges of all of the major ice advances, and the Ragby route will go across half a dozen different moraines.
How much preparation did all of you have to do as far as traveling this route? Did you actually have to go out and travel the route so that you could see what the riders will be looking at, John?
No, actually, with modern mapping technologies that we can do on the computers, it's remarkable using aerial photographs and all sorts of other kinds of mapping that's available to us now that we could do sort of a virtual review of the entire route and pick out where there are interesting features. In fact, we had a real fun session over at Ray's office. There were probably 20 people in the room from six or seven different organizations, the USGS folks as well as the DNR and folks on my staff, and we just put up a GIS map on a big screen and then just rolled across the state, zooming in and out as different people said, hey, what about this feature? What about that feature? The Rockford Quarry came up, or the Grotto at West Bend, or the Cowan Archaeological Site, and we just did a review, and it was really fun to have all these different scientists, as Ray describes it. It's really teamology, fill in whatever science you want, getting together and pulling out the interesting features of the Iowa landscape.
Well, we will talk more about that and what the riders will be seeing day two through day seven in just a moment. And you are welcome to join our conversation. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today are John Dorshuk and John Hall from the Office of the State Archaeologist and Ray Anderson, a geologist with the DNR's Iowa Geological and Water Survey. More to come. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we are talking about the natural history and the human history of the state of Iowa. As Ragby riders cross the state next week, they will have an opportunity to interact with Team Archaeology from the Office of the State Archaeologist. They've put together a handout that catalogs some of the archaeological features that they'll be seeing as they cross the state. And also we have with us Ray Anderson, who's a geologist with the DNR's Iowa Geological and Water Survey. They've also put together information on the natural land formations that the riders will be experiencing as they travel across the state next week. John Dorshuk is the state archaeologist. John Hall is also with the Office of the State Archaeologist. And we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, and you can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So let's talk about day two, which goes from Storm Lake to Algona. And you use this as an opportunity to, in your materials, talk about a number of the great hoaxes in Iowa archaeology. And that's because the route goes near Kossuth. And Tell me, for those who don't remember, a little bit about the Kossuth Giants. Which John wants to tackle that one?
Well, I'll take it. I forget how long ago it was, but somebody played a hoax and dug up. They posted on a website something called the Kossuth Giants, and it was just literally just a written hoax. There was no hard material or anything like that. And some other website grabbed a hold of it and ran with it. And so much though that even our SHPO writer from the State Historic Preservation Office, Dan Higginbottom, actually took calls about this hoax, and it kind of snowballed and got out of control. But yeah, going through Kossuth County, it gave us an opportunity to talk about some of the hoaxes that have taken place throughout the history in Iowa. It was pretty interesting, actually.
And what were these Kossuth Giants supposed to be?
I forget exactly, but they were like giant red-headed creatures that they found in like a subterranean tomb. And it was like a writer's workshop hoax, actually, that some of the fiction writers got together and did, but it took on a life of its own.
It's linked to a pretty constant theme in North American archaeology that the Vikings were here in large numbers at a relatively early date, about the same time that the Cowan site would have been occupied, about 1000 AD. And we do know from archaeological research that's been done on the east coast of North America that small numbers of Vikings did come over, establish a few settlements. They failed relatively quickly, and they decided it wasn't a very hospitable place to try to make a living. But there's persistent rumor all across the middle part of the continent that that you can find runes or other kinds of evidence of early Viking civilizations that might have been here up to 1,000 years ago. None of it's panned out, though, when you
right.
look closely.
Not yet.
Not yet. That's right. It's out there to find. So the Cardiff Giant was one example of these were sculptures, perhaps, of these early Vikings who'd come through.
We have Holly Ann on the line in Eagle Grove. Oh! No, we don't seem to have Holly. Holly, maybe can you turn down your radio for us? Or maybe she's gone now. We were getting some feedback there. So we have Bob on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Bob.
Oh, yeah, it's one of the things that would be a good thing to heads up to look for as they're riding along is the erosion that is caused by a lot of the farming, where they've taken out all the fence rows and using a lot of big equipment. Everybody's got to get big. And they should be able to see gullies forming and on slopes and depression. And the thing probably they won't see is the sheet erosion. At one of the rest stops along Interstate 80, they've got columns to represent the average soil depth in Iowa. 1850, it was 14 inches. 2000, it's 5.5 inches. That's the average for the whole state, their predicted average for soil depth. So we've lost well over half of our total soil since 1850 to 2000. And people, I think, should be concerned. Riding along, you'll be able to see a firsthand of that. I mean, people who maybe predominantly are not farmers or city people, if they look up, they'll see that. And then maybe they would become concerned.
Well, Bob, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Ray, is that something you're hoping people will pick up on?
Well, boy, you know, you won't be able to miss that, particularly when you start out in the Les Hills. You'll see incredibly deep gullying. You'll see the incredible amount of money that has been spent putting in terraces or other types of soil erosion prevention things to make the hilly land somewhat farmable. Probably not a good idea. But the amount of erosion is exactly right. You can see a lot of that sheet erosion if you happen to be caught in a big rainstorm up on the Des Moines Lobe where it's relatively flat. And I'm sure that John can tell you a little bit about how much erosion there's been. There's actually a whole soil class for the amount of material that's been deposited in floodplains since the settlers arrived here.
Have we noticed any kind of a shift in erosion patterns, though, with changes in farming technology? Because, of course, one of the things that you don't see as often now is fall tilling. And so that's supposed to cut down on erosion, but have there been other changes that maybe have caused more?
Absolutely. I suspect that the development of the ethanol industry has been one of the worst, because there was a lot of land that was set aside for erosion protection, and et cetera, before that. And since then, the economy of corn has been such that farmers are taking all this land and developing it into corn and increased tiling, et cetera, to make lands that aren't really suitable, better suitable for growing. It's pretty incredible the amounts increased.
We've noticed over the last several decades, when going out and doing archaeological survey projects around the state, that the degree of erosion is such that archaeological sites are being impacted, because many of those are in what are now plowed agricultural fields. And where we look back at our records from, say, 30 years ago, there was greater topsoil depth even that recently. Now, as the farming continues, the plows are cutting down, even with the low impact methods, cutting down into the subsoil to a greater and greater degree as the topsoil gets moved off, and the archaeological deposits that are encased down below are getting impacted to a greater degree. So that's one kind of evidence that we have. And then, as Ray mentioned, what we see when we go into the valley areas, so not on the uplands necessarily where the soil is coming from, but you get into the valleys, that's where it's ending up. If it doesn't actually flow away in the stream, it's building up on the what were the floodplains and the low terraces. So there, the effect is actually good for archaeology, because it preserves and protects burying deposits at greater and greater depth.
Well, thank you, Bob, so much for your call. You can join our conversation by calling 866-780-9100. And I want to move on to day three, which is from Algona to Clear Lake. And it takes the riders near a World War II prisoner of war camp, or actually a very large prisoner of war camp near Algona. Can you tell me a little bit about the camp?
Yeah, between 1944 and 1946, there was about 10,000 German soldiers encamped there, prisoners of war. And Algona was kind of the center of a bunch of satellite camps. And ironically enough, Storm Lake and Charles City also had camps, and they are also overnight towns on the Ragbrite route this year. So we thought it was pretty important to bring this little historical fact to light in the Ragbrite brochure.
And this is fairly recent history. And, of course, we're going from talking about 1000 AD to talking about, 80 years ago. So how does that fall under the umbrella of archaeology?
Well, archaeologists like to co-opt as much of the past as they can. So we're willing to study things that are relatively recent that perhaps a historian might say is their purview. But what's interesting is the physical record of what's preserved at a place almost always can add to the story that a historian might be able to tell from documentary records or written records. And the farther back you go into the past, then the historical written documents fall away, and you have to rely more and more on just the physical remains that are present. But historical archaeology is a growing field of specialty within the overall archaeological studies. And this is in part because our society, as it moves into the future, is becoming more aware of change and how what our grandparents experienced or great-grandparents experienced, say, at the end of the 19th century or even into the early 20th century, is no longer a way of life that we're real familiar with. And actually, going back to the landscape issue, one change that's occurring is consolidation of small family farms into big farms. So it changes the way the landscape looks, and the riders will notice that too, I think.
We're talking about the archaeology and the natural history of the state of Iowa and what Ragbrite riders are going to see and learn about that if they choose to as they travel across the state next week. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are talking about the archaeological and natural history of the state of Iowa today. And with me, I have members of Team Archaeology. They're a cycling team put together by the Office of the State Archaeologist. They'll be going on Ragbrite next week and also helping riders on Ragbrite get to know a little bit about the archaeological history of our state. John Dorshuk is the state archaeologist, and John Hall is a GIS technician and in the geospatial program at the office. He's also the chair of Team Archaeology, the guy who tells everybody else that they have to get in shape for the ride, right? That's your...
I should have told myself, I think.
Right. And we also have Ray Anderson with us. He's a geologist with the DNR's Iowa Geological and Water Survey. He'll also be along the route this year educating riders about the natural history and land formations in the state. And Ray, let's start with you this time. I want to move on to day four, which is from Clear Lake to Charles City. What kind of landscape will the riders be going through on that day?
Well, I think that the main thing that they'll be doing there is going off of the Des Moines Lobe, no more of this flat stuff. But they will be going onto a feature that we call the Iowan erosion surface. It is kind of – we describe it as gently rolling. It's gentle hills, not near as bad as what you would see out in western Iowa or that you'll experience in the eastern part of the state.
And also along that route, they will pass by the Rockford Fossil Park and Prairie Preserve. Tell me a little bit about that area.
Well, that's really a wonderful facility. It's run by the Floyd County Conservation Board. They have a very nice visitor center there, and it's kind of centered around an old quarry. This was a quarry that was in mine Devonian shale that was deposited 375 million years ago. They mined that shale to produce drainage tiles, bricks. There are still some old kilns there on the site. But the unique part about it is a unit right above the shale unit is a shaley limestone that is just full of really nice small fossils. These fossils weather out when it rains. You can just bend over and pick them up. And fossil collecting is encouraged there, so that's one of the really unique places where people can go and collect a wonderful variety of fossils.
And also they have 60 acres. Is it reconstructed prairie that's there?
Yes, it's mostly reconstructed prairie. They had a few patches of natural prairie, but mostly reconstructed. It's a very beautiful site.
So riders can actually get a chance to see what the landscape would have looked like without all the farm fields.
And experience a visitor center with air conditioning and flush toilets.
Okay, now you've got your priorities in line. And in your brochure, on the archaeology brochure, you guys focused on architecture for that part of the ride. Why did you choose to talk about architecture?
That's a good question. We at the OSA, we also have architectural historians, and one of the unique things about this ride is it goes through a bunch of cities that show the Prairie School architecture, from Algona to Clear Lake to Charles City to Waterloo. They all have just beautiful examples of Prairie School architecture, and we thought, wow, it's just a perfect fit for showing out-of-state riders what we have in the state for this very unique architecture.
Right. Iowa isn't thought of as being a pinnacle of architecture by many people out of the state. I guess Iowa isn't thought of by many people out of the state in many ways.
Well, that's why Ragbri is such a wonderful opportunity, because it attracts a lot of people from out of state to come here. So one of our goals is to educate Iowans about Iowa, but also to do some good work on behalf of the state with those who come here to visit from other places and open their eyes to what Iowa's all about.
Now, on day five, Charles City to Waterloo, the riders will be passing by an archaeological site on the Shell Rock River. What is there?
This is one of many archaeological sites that represent what we call the Archaic period. And this is, again, an archaeological label that we create for convenience of comparison. But the Archaic period was characterized by the time before agriculture. So this is a time when the Native American populations in North America were surviving just using naturally occurring resources, hunting, gathering, fishing, all the different kinds of plants and animals that were available to them. And it was a relatively rich environment for that kind of lifestyle, as long as population densities didn't get too high. And for much of the Archaic, which spans a period from approximately 9,000 years ago to around 3,000 years ago, and those are just very round numbers for comparative purposes, this was the dominant lifestyle. But what started to occur near the end of the Archaic was increasing population densities in some places. And that's where the first experimentation then with planting various kinds of crops and moving into horticulture, which eventually led to agriculture, would have taken place. the particular site on the Shell Rock that that we feature in our booklet, 13BT13 is the official site number, was investigated as part of a bridge replacement project by the Iowa Department of Transportation. And it included some historic deposits overlaying these early archaic deposits. So it's kind of a interesting context where there's multiple cultural activities in the same place.
You can join our conversation today if you have any questions about state archaeology or geology. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPRTalk. And one of the things that you tell riders to look out for are outcroppings of Blanding chert. What are you talking about? Ray, do you want to answer that?
Chert is actually a form of very fine-grained quartz, which is silicon and oxygen combined to form that mineral. And it was utilized a lot by Native Americans for spear points, et cetera. Chert and flint are effectively the same thing. And so it's utilized a lot in that sense. And it's actually formed from the skeleton and pieces from sponges primarily that were remobilized by groundwater and deposited within the limestone as chert.
And what would you see if you actually were looking for it along the roadside?
Well, generally what you see is the normal brownish, pale brownish-colored limestone. Then you'll see generally whitish or maybe off-white-colored patches within that, and they'll stand out as something different. And that's what you should look for, something different within these rock outcrops, and that may be the chert.
Okay. And in your display, as you're going to have a couple of days where you're actually set up along the route, and you're also going to be at the expo, and you're going to be really showing people how the natives to the area actually made these spear points.
Yeah, I have a couple of staff members, Kevin Verhulst and Mark Anderson, who are both very accomplished flint knappers. That is, they make stone tools in the way that Native Americans did in the ancient past. And they're able to replicate many of the types that archaeologists have been able to demonstrate are of certain ages based on their context at archaeological sites around the state. And our booklet this year features a poster, actually, that covers from about 1,000 years ago to 12,000 years ago all the different projectile point types, spear points and later arrow points that are typical in Iowa and the Midwest in general. And Mark and Kevin will be demonstrating these techniques. So folks should look for us at Expo. They might hear us first. The distinctive clink-clink of stone on stone will signal that Kevin's in the area, and come and see him make one of these projectile points if they're interested.
And what are the other ways that riders can connect with you along the route?
Well, as John mentioned, the ride team does have very distinctive jerseys, Team Archaeology jerseys. And if somebody wants to get a preview of what that looks like, they can go to the Team Archaeology website, iowaarchaeology.org, I think is the quickest way to get there. So they can look for one of those riders any day or in the campgrounds overnight, and feel free to come up and ask them any question about archaeology they want. That's why they're out there. And then we'll have four locations during the week at Expo on Saturday this week. And then Sunday will be just a little bit east of Quimby on the ride route. As it turns out, an archaeological acquaintance of mine has a property that the ride route goes right by, and he's generously allowed us to set up our booth there. And then on day five, we will be just east of Dyke on, I think it's D19 is the road. Again, the route goes right by the J.H. Rodman County Park, Grundy County Park, and so we'll be set up there. And then in the town of Quasqueton on day six. So we'll be right in the thick of things there.
And Ray, will you be a part of these booths, or do you have a different kind of outreach that you'll be able to do along the route?
Well, we've been producing these brochures that tell people what they can see each day of the ride for all of the 6 years. But this is the first time that we're actually going to be out there on the road. John was good enough to invite us to join him at the expo at the booth there. And then we're going to join some of our colleagues from the U.S. Geological Survey here in town who have helped us prepare these brochures. Been great help, as a matter of fact. We're going to join them at the campgrounds at Storm Lake and actually go around in the evening and talk to people. And they've they've always valued this quite a bit, and so we're looking forward to that. And then we're also going to be at the Grotto of the Redemption, which is one of the stops. The route goes very near there in West Bend, which is a wonderful I don't know quite how to describe it. Many, many types of rocks plastered together, and we'll be there to help people, too, if they want to do the rocks. And then finally on Wednesday, we're going to go up to Rockford and set up a little booth there. We'll be passing out small Ziploc bags for people to collect fossils in and helping them with the identification.
Oh, that's wonderful. So this will be the first year that you're out there, but you guys have been out there interacting with people for the last couple of years. Has there been a lot of interest? Do people see your shirts and say, hey?
Absolutely. We've had a great response. In fact, this year, before we even had the booklet made, we had people contacting us to see when they could get it and if they would send it out. We would send it out to them early. But, when we're on the route, I think last year stood out because I talked to a teacher from southeast Iowa for like 20 minutes on the route. It was a lot of fun, actually.
Oh, that's terrific. What are some of the standouts from the last few years that you went close to, that you really got to draw people's attention to? Oh, totally put you on the spot, didn't I?
I've just been really enthusiastic about the response to our outreach booth. I know that the team gets a lot of attention as they ride, but everywhere that we've set up the last couple of years, people come and they're interested in the past. And I think that's a basic component of being human. And I think our society also values the past as a defining element of who we are today. And whether it's your grandparents or whether it's so far back, you can't connect on a genetic basis, it's still people and how people survived in the past and without the modern conveniences is always fascinating to people. And I think a value in terms of us appreciating what we have today and how we can sustain that. So it fits.
I think it's probably safe to say that most people probably still get most of their information about archaeology from Indiana Jones or maybe from the Tomb Raider video game. Maybe that's out of style. I'm dating myself. But what do you want to teach people about modern archaeology?
I would like the take-home message to be that the past has value to the present. It's interesting beyond just the artifacts on a shelf. Everyone marvels over the creation of a stone spear point or an ancient pot, and that's good. But thinking about the people and decision-making is, I think, really valuable for us as we move as a society into the future with energy issues, food issues, climate issues. These are issues that human beings have always dealt with, and if we can understand how it was dealt with in the past, we might add some tools to our equipment to deal with it in the future.
How many digs do you have going on in the state of Iowa right now?
Currently, our office, I think, has maybe three projects going on where they're actually excavating, but it ebbs and flows. Sometimes there are periods when there's none going on to then where we have a half dozen crews or more out. So it's really a response to the development cycle that goes on.
Now, of course, the digging is the part of archaeology that people actually know about because that's what we see, and I suppose that's the sexiest part of archaeology. How much of a project does that part of it make up?
Well, we usually characterize it as about a quarter of the work. It's probably a 3-to-1 ratio of every day you spend in the field. You probably have 3 days in the lab and at the computer writing, pulling together background material, preparing the items that you dig up for curation long term so they're available for other researchers and for the public in general to view. So it's just sort of the tip of the iceberg to be out in the field doing that initial discovery process.
And what do you do back in the lab?
Well, the lab is a multi-step process of cleaning materials, stabilizing them to preserve them. Some things are very, very fragile when they come out of the ground. Others are more durable. The analysis process, you have to have various specialists look at the types of material, whether it be the flakes from stone tool making or the potsherds that come from what was once a complete container, the decorative elements versus the technological elements of tempering, for example, or take different kinds of specialists to look at, animal bone identifications, all range of specialties. And then as John's program does, the geospatial program, the whole mapping element. element, the contextual aspect of where were these things, that's something we track very carefully.
And what is your ultimate goal? I mean, obviously you are learning about the past, you're learning about the people who lived in the past, but what are you hoping to take away from each project?
Well, our mission is to preserve and also educate. So the preservation aspect has to do with discovery. We have to find these things before that we can preserve them. And then the education part is sort of the back end of that cycle. It really never ends. Every time we excavate somewhere, we learn something new and sets up new questions. But we're trying to, given the resources made available to us, find out as much as we can before it's destroyed, because archaeological sites are non-renewable resources. They were made by people in the past. There's no one out there, short of my staff members, who are making spear points anymore. They certainly aren't being used the way they once were. So to a great degree, we have one shot at getting at these archaeological sites before they're destroyed, whether it be by an agricultural practice or a development going in on a new highway or sewage lagoon or cell tower. So we try to get there in front of those developments. We try to work with developers so that we can get the information and record it before the improvement is made, and in that way help record what the past was like.
Well, let's before we go, I want to talk about day 7, which is from Manchester to Dubuque. And Ray, let's start with you. What kind of landscape will the riders be experiencing on that day?
Well, we're wandering into an area that we call the Paleozoic Plateau. This is an area that's been called the Driftless Area by a lot of people. Drift being glacial till and glacial materials, and there are very few of those up in this area. People thought that there were no glaciers in this area. In fact, they were glaciated, been mostly eroded away. But that area is dominantly bedrock controlled. You find a lot of very steep valleys, deep river channels cut into this bedrock, some spectacular views, some very difficult riding. You'll get a chance to see some of Iowa's oldest rocks in this area.
All right. And it also, in your brochure, you highlight the mines of Spain. Tell me a little bit about the mines of Spain.
The Dubuque area is probably one of the better known historic portions of Iowa, and is, of course, named for Julian Dubuque, who had a permit or land grant from the governor of New Spain, and allowed him to cross the Mississippi, essentially, and set up what was one of the first European settlements in what became the state of Iowa. And this area had been well known to Native American populations. The Meskwaki, for example, had been lead mining there for several centuries prior to the Europeans coming in. But that whole area around Dubuque is littered with old mines, basically, that were used for the lead mining purposes. And there's a state park there, the Mines of Spain State Park, that is helps document some of that.
So as you interact with people across the state throughout the week of RAGBRAI, what do you hope that some of the people that you interact with will take away from seeing your materials and talking to you about archaeology?
Well, we hope they take a little information about Iowa back with them. I earlier in the week, you had a program on RAGBRAI, and it seemed to me that a lot of people have an association with Iowa already, whether they live here or not, and that already shows an interest coming back to the state. And I think if we can kind of up the ante and give them a little more information about the state, maybe they'll keep coming back.
John, do you have anything you want to add?
I guess I'll reiterate that the past has value to the present, and I'd like that to be the take-home message, I think.
How about you, Ray? What do you want people to take away from the week?
Well, I think when most people think about state of Iowa, they think about corn and flat and all of that. But that Iowa has an incredible, interesting geologic history. Much of it is covered by glacial materials, but that has an interesting history in and of itself. People like us that work in Iowa geology find it just fascinating. We don't have great mountains. We don't have great canyons. But the geology is a lot subtler, but incredibly interesting. And if you can read these brochures and look around as you're traveling, you'll see some of the fascinating things that make us love Iowa geology.
So when did you fall in love with Iowa geology? What was it about the state that made you start looking more closely?
I actually started out my career in engineering school and then was casting around for something else to do when that didn't prove too interesting. Ran into geology, found some interesting professors with an interesting topic, got looking at it, studying it, ended up being a geology major, ended up working for the Iowa Survey. And once you start seeing in detail, taking time to look at what we have to offer geologically here in Iowa, it's hard not to fall in love with it.
So it sounds like for all of you, the goal is to get people to stop and slow down and really look at what's around them.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Life is going at a rapid pace, and enjoying what's around you is certainly part of the quality of life. So I think all of us appreciate the natural world and then the human overlay to that to a much greater degree perhaps than the average person. So we'd like to share that.
Now, a lot of people who lived in Iowa in the past, you were talking about the Cowan site earlier and how they buried their corn underground, and so now you have carbonized seeds. Of course, a lot of people buried a lot of things here in the state of Iowa just to get rid of it. You know, if you visit almost any old farm site, you will find their dump site, whether it's been covered or not yet covered. If people run into an area like that, is that of archaeological interest, even if it's a not you know thousands of years old, but 100 years old?
That's a tricky evaluation question. There's a great deal of redundancy in material as you get closer and closer to the present. The ubiquitous pop can, for example. So we need to use a little bit of judgment about what's really unique and isn't getting recorded about our past versus what there's a lot of. So I'd say yes, but qualified. And if we're running out of time, I'd like to just make sure we thank Humanities Iowa. They've been generous supporters of Iowa Archaeology Month now for well over a decade, and we appreciate their support.
All right. Terrific. We've been talking to members of Team Archaeology. John Dorshuk is the state archaeologist. John Hall also works in the Office of the State Archaeologist. Ray Anderson is a geologist with the DNR's Iowa Geological and Water Survey. Thank you all for joining us today. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Rosalind Sixby. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.